guaranteed, this will be the hardest fucking day of your life. This week's podcast episode is brought to you by The Crucible. Weak men suck, and how not to suck. The Crucible is a groundbreaking and revolutionary intensive training program designed for men to learn, live, and lead their family into the unknown future with certainty, confidence, and power. The mission is simple, not easy, to expand, grow, and impact the hearts, minds, health, and spirit of the men who show up relentlessly, love unconditionally, and never give up on the endless game of self-mastery. Why? Because most men have never been educated or informed on how to achieve greatness in every area of their life, let alone lead and influence others on how to live their own extraordinary one. Apply now to see if you have what it takes to expand and grow in the arena of life and create an unfucking recognizable version of the man that stands today.
Welcome to the Fathers of the Future podcast. I'm excited to be here today because calling people out works, and in a good way. I'm joined by a friend, a fan, somebody that I've known for many years on the spotlight of Major League Baseball, long before I knew that we shared a zip code here in Scottsdale and Paradise Valley, Arizona. Eric Gagne, welcome to the Fathers of the Future podcast.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Good to be here.
Yeah, it's going to be fun, man. We're sitting outside in beautiful Arizona. It's under 100 degrees, which means it feels cool for us. And we're at Sip Coffee House in Arcadia. And you live just a couple miles from here, and I live a couple miles north from here. And we're sitting outside, and this is truly the reemergence. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons why we wanted to shoot this podcast was not only did I want to hear your story about fatherhood and mm-hmm. your time in the big leagues. You're a Cy Young winner. You are a world champion. You're a three-time All-Star. There's a ton of accolades that go with you professionally. But now that title of dad has outlived the title of pitcher.
Always does, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a lifelong journey, man. So right. Welcome. So happy to have you here. And before I get into how I think we finally got together, give us your introduction, man. And you're definitely raw. We talked about that in the precast, which is why I'm really excited to go down this rabbit hole with you.
Yep.
Because it's going to get crazy. And that's a good thing, man. It's good to be a little crazy. There's a ton of people driving through, mm-hmm. picking up their coffee. But our hope is that we can inspire some people to get outside and get going.
Yeah, that's the whole plan. You're just going to just get the guys or whoever's at home right now just kind of going crazy a little bit. You can't really do anything. And, we're lucky here in Scottsdale. There's a lot of people that are stuck, in Montreal. My kids are in Montreal and they're stuck there. They're stuck in their house and they're lucky they got a gym and everything else. So we're pretty lucky here. I still have a smile on my face every day. I wake up blue sky. So it's a lot easier for me. So I can't complain. And hopefully guys can go out and just be smart. They'll go out there, be smart. Just encourage all the small business around you. Just kind of help them out because it's been hard. It's going to be hard. It's going to be a long run. So just kind of go out there, encourage them, put a smile on someone else's face just because you guys are going to feel down. I feel down once in a while, but you see some guys just wave at you. It just helps you a little bit. And
yeah, it does.
It's pretty cool how you see like the community come together. It's as bad as it is, it's going to get better. And I think people are really excited about getting out, but you got to be smart. Just go smart and really help your neighbors.
And how strict is Canada in general from a society and a country compared to us?
It's very strict, but I mean, I don't want to say strict. I say it's different. I mean, it's not the same. It's like they're scared a little bit more. It's, especially there, the way it is in Montreal downtown is very, very, it's a small island. So there's a lot of people. They're really on top of each other. So, the virus there is a little bit worse and it's hard. I mean, the weather is bad there. They just got snow probably a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. It's just very, very difficult. And I moved to Arizona because of the sun. I think the sun gives me a good, great mood and everything else. And when you go to Montreal, you don't see the sun. It's 3:30, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And it's dark. So it's got to be very hard mentally. And I can feel that. I mean, I go there a week and it's hard. It's hard for me. So I'm spoiled. I'm here in Scottsdale. So I'm going to enjoy it and try to give some sun rays to the people in Canada, maybe.
You got an Arizona tan, man.
That's right.
I'm sure your friends and family are pretty jealous of that.
They're very jealous.
When did you start coming to Arizona?
I started coming here spring training. Actually, I was in with the Dodgers. I came down for, it's called Instructional League. So you come down, the young guys just come down. I went to the Padres in Peoria Padres and Mariners, and the Dodgers are practicing there. You just kind of, if you work on curveball or whatever like this, you just go there and they do instruction. And that was my first time. And back then it was, I was used to take Scottsdale Road all the way. I'm sorry, Bell all the way from Peoria all the way down. Then to go to Scottsdale to go to Old Town. It took like an hour and a half back
then. There was no 101.
Nothing. It was no loop or nothing. So it was back then it was nothing. I used to run around. It was, I think it was a Chili's. And maybe a La Quinta. That's it. That's what we stayed at La Quinta. And there's one Chili's or whatever. But we were literally by ourselves over there and just practicing baseball. And it was pretty special. We used to have a bunch of big bowl of soup, split all that together. We used to have a loaf of bread and peanut butter and jelly. That's what our lunch were. If you're not there first, you got to, you know, just got to scrape the peanut butter out.
So share with us going back. How did you get into baseball being from Canada? You know, I was a kid watching the Toronto Blue Jays. I was an Oakland A's fan. So, you know, the Bash Brothers, you were right around that exact same time coming in the league.
Yeah. I mean, I had a chance to, my first year was in 99, I believe. Yeah. 99. And then I started playing baseball because I love baseball. Every single day I wanted to go play catch. My dad was not an athlete, but I played catch with him all the time. My dad was always really involved with us. And he didn't want me to play one sport. He wanted me to pick two sports. And for, you know, we didn't have a lot of money, but we had enough. We were very comfortable, you know, we never missed anything. So I can't really say we had a hard time or whatever. My dad always worked his butt off. My mom's always worked. So we always had some, we always had what we wanted, what we needed, sorry. And then it's, he told me, he's just gonna do stuff, do different stuff. Just, you know, make sure that when you do something, do it the you know, as hard as you can, as long as you can, as best as you can. And that's what I did. And he did the same thing with the hockey. He said, if you do something, you know, I'm paying $300 a year, you better play the whole year. You don't quit. So for me, it was very exciting to see that. My dad was very supportive. He was just a positive attitude. He was not a good athlete. He didn't know how to throw, didn't know how to do anything. I kind of taught him that when I was like 10, 11 years old. And he just wanted me to do other sports, explore stuff and just, you know, he used to go travel all the time. My dad worked to travel, and that's what he wanted, just to see different culture. And I think that's what I got a little bit in me. I wanted to go see the world. And when I was 14, I left. I left Montreal. I left my hometown actually just to go work or to go play baseball in a school in Montreal. So that was like 2-3 hour bus every single morning, every day, every night. It was very hard, but I wanted to do it just to play baseball. And that was a sports school. We had hockey. I think we had synchronized swimming. We had baseball. So that was really, really fun. That was a little crazy environment because at 14 years old, you live in an apartment with two of your friends. You make some stupid mistakes. But I was lucky because the guys I live with are super mature. So that's – I love baseball, but hockey was my love too. I had always had a couple – you know, to me, that's the balance. You need something that you want to fall off on. You know, you have hockey, you have baseball. But
do you still get on the ice now?
Oh, yeah. I mean – I haven't done it in probably a year and a half, 2 years. We used to have all the guys here at Scottsdale, all the baseball players. I shouldn't say that, but because we had the biggest payroll probably on any NHL team. We had like probably $150 million on the ice when we played. That was really cool.
Your love for baseball and your love for hockey, at what point did you have to make a decision? When did you need to decide that you had to go one way or the other?
Well, that was chosen for me, I think, because when a scout came to me, I was 16 years old, and he said, you know, you kind of want to think about baseball because you're really good. I mean, you could get paid for this. I'm like, okay, get paid to play baseball. Like,
at 16, so, that's when you knew.
At 16. At 15, he talked to me, but 16, 17, that's when I had to make my decision because he started me playing midget triple-A or play baseball. It's starting to blend a little bit. You can't really do both. So at 16, I decided to go with baseball, and I played midget triple-A, and then that's when I went – full board baseball. I kind of just say I'm going to go that route, and I just went. And
did you know prior to that at all that you were leaps and bounds above everybody else?
I knew it was really good, but I had no idea I could get drafted. I didn't know I could get drafted. I didn't know I could be in the big leagues. I didn't know how the whole road process to get to this. I didn't know that. So to me, it was kind of weird when the White Sox called and the Dodgers was Claude Pelletier. He's one of our scouts. He's the first guy that actually saw me. When I was 14, 15, 16, he's always followed me. So he knew me. He really knew me as a person. You know, he knew the struggles with my father, my mom. They got divorced. They knew I was a rebel.
How old were you when they got divorced?
I think I was 15 or 14 or 15. That was exactly when I moved out of the house. That's when my parents kind of got divorced. My brother was stuck in the middle of that. That was a shitstorm. But, you know, that was pretty hard for him. But for me, I had something to fall off. It was baseball. It was just my baseball kind of kept me a little sane. And I just like, he went down the little path, the little rabbit hole, and then he came out and a lot stronger. Now he's very good. But, you know, that's the thing. The sports really keep you, I think, grounded, keeps you focused on other things and negative stuff. So to me, that really, I think it saved my life. Baseball really did save my life.
That's beautiful. And you talk about your journey, right? 15, 16, there's an awakening, man. I want to travel. I want to make some money. I want to support myself. And, you know, I want to look at life from a bigger picture. Mm-hmm. And walk us through what the next 10 years look like.
My gosh. I mean,
and
that
how, when
was
do you
so
have
much.
Your kid? When
so I had my kid. So I kind of, when I went to Seminole Junior College, so that's where I was decided to go baseball, full board baseball. My buddy of mine, he had a full scholarship to go to Seminole. I wanted to quit baseball. I quit. I got kicked out of Baseball Canada. I got kicked out of everywhere in Canada. I couldn't play because I was in trouble all the time. So I didn't want to go. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to quit. Screw this. I'm done with this. I'm going to go travel. So I wanted to go to Europe. My idea was to just go backpack and figure it out, go work or go something, do something over there, maybe play hockey in Europe. That was my plan. My plan was to go in Europe somewhere and just kind of figure it out. And I left. I was going to leave. I was ready to buy stuff. I had $500. I was going to find a way to go to Europe and figure it out. And then my buddy goes, "Now just come to Seminole, Oklahoma." I'm like, "I don't even know where that is. I've never left anywhere but, you know, Montreal, a little outside of Montreal a little bit." So I'm like, "All right, fuck it, I'll go up there." And then worst case is I'll go up and it's going to be a lot cheaper from Seminole, Oklahoma to Oklahoma City to anywhere in Europe. So I'm like, "All right, maybe I'll save a little bit of money. I'll use that and I'll leave." I had no plan of going anywhere there. I mean, I didn't even think I was going to stay. So that's when my parents were getting divorced. I was leaving my girlfriend. I mean, it was just a lot of work. I didn't speak a word of English either. So that didn't help. We go straight to Oklahoma. And when I landed, Lloyd Simmons was my coach. And that man is an absolute maniac, but in a good way. I mean, he just gets you right. He knows how to push people. He knows how to really get you in a mode where, you know, you talk beast mode. I think he got the best out of people like that. He just pushed people the right way. He knew how to get the best out of everybody. And that's why Seminole Junior College got the most win. I think he's got the most wins in any junior college. And he's a pretty special person. You know, he worked hard. He worked out before us. He used to wake up at 4:35. He told us, "Hey, don't brush your teeth because you guys are going to throw up no matter what." So at 8:00, they're like, "Brush your teeth." I'm like, "Yeah. Oh, no, I'm going to throw up tomorrow." So these things like that, he just say, "Hey, man, you guys are going to throw up for sure. So just make sure you don't brush your teeth." And he would be there, him and his wife, earlier than us. And he was sweating already. I'm like, "Oh, my gosh." So we do morning weights. We do all that kind of stuff. And it was really cool because it really bonded the team together. And we're all dying together, all freaking like, it was really hard.
And how did you adjust to Oklahoma?
I mean, I just did it. I didn't really know how to speak English. The guys there were really, really, really nice to me. That's the biggest thing. Cause I didn't speak a word of English. I had to go there and learn classes, learn American history, learn all this stuff that I had no idea. I didn't speak a word of English. So it's kind of really hard for me, but I taped all the classes. And then the guys would come to my room after and it's kind of keep talking to me with different words. So I would learn 3, 4, 5 words for one word, like definitions and how to use it, when to use it. So that was about 5 or 6 months of straight headaches. That was hard, but I learned. The guys, you know, they're making fun of me a lot. You know, I've been laughed at a lot, but you know, that's why you fight a lot.
Yeah.
When in doubt, start swinging.
Yeah. That scrapper mentality was built inside of you, but then it really started to grow. You were at Seminole for 2 years?
1 year.
1 year. Mm-hmm. And then how soon do you go into the minors? And then let us know, you know, the switch from starting pitcher mm-hmm. to closer to game over. Because that's an amazing journey, man. And I remember growing up, you know, again, a couple years apart, but just following that, mm-hmm. growing up in Southern California, being a, you know, a Dodger fan and just seeing this fucking animal on the mound.
I was caged for a long time as a starter, I think. I feel like when I was a starter in minor leagues, when I start with Seminole, I pitched there. I pitched really well. I went to pitch for Team Canada. And I don't think I gave up a run that summer. That was a really good summer. That's when I signed with the Dodgers. Negotiated my own contract. No idea what I was doing.
When did Scott Boras come in the picture?
Oh, that was in Double A. Yeah. That's after I was really good.
Yeah. He wanted a piece of the
action.
That's
right. Yeah. And then before that was Craig Katz. Was my Katz and Landis were my agency. Craig Katz, a good friend of mine in LA. It was Katz and Landis. It was my agency, and I remember leaving them. I'm like, I had no reason to leave. Zero. They're really good. They're really nice. Always perfect. And then he comes to me. He goes, man, why are you leaving? I'm like, I have zero reason, man. I'm like, that's Scott Boras. And to me, back then, it was just the name. To me, it was pretty important. You know, I thought he was could put me in a better position. I didn't really know Cats and Landis yet. I knew there had a lot of sports. And all I knew is Boras was only baseball. So to me, that was, you know, I wanted to go with them. But yeah, you know, Craig understood that. Didn't give me any bad feeling or nothing. We still talk once in a while and see him at Dodger game once in a while. So it's all good. And
who was your favorite growing up? Who were your top three baseball players?
I would say Roger Clemens, just the way he pitched. That was just a crazy animal. And then Tim Wallach, Eli, he was one of my favorite person, I think, because it helped. I was a third baseman when I grew up. I wanted to be a third baseman. I wanted to be Tim Wallach. But these guys were just like, and I met him. He was actually coached with the Dodgers, and I met him. He's such a nice person. That's probably my favorite player, I think, of all time, was Tim Wallach. And then Jeff Reardon. I don't know if you guys remember. Yep, Jeff Reardon is a pitcher for the Expos.
Yeah.
Expo guys are all my – what I was looking up to. I didn't know how to get there. The funny thing, you asked me earlier, how did you ever get to the big leagues? How did you know? I didn't know. But I knew that there – that's the one thing about having a professional sport team in your city. You dream about being there. I dreamed about being on that mound in Olympic Stadium and just pitching. You know, that's what I wanted to do. I wasn't sure how to get there, but I wanted to do that. And I remember John Wetland used to pitch. I was like, oh, my God, this is amazing. O. Henry. You know, we'd throw the O. Henry bars on the field. And just a lot of stuff like that stuck with me, and I think I wanted that. And I don't know if it was on purpose or not, but I always wanted to be a baseball player. And then when he came up to me, he said, hey, you can be a really good baseball player. I'm like, all right, that's okay. I took that seriously. Then I went to Seminole. Really did everything I wanted to do in Seminole. I worked my butt off. I learned English. I came out of there. I got signed with the Dodgers after Team Canada. I signed with the Dodgers because I really wanted to make sure that I wanted to be somewhere that it knew me, they wanted me. And the Dodgers say, you know what, if you sign with us, we'll bring you an instructional league, which was a big deal back then because I would have to skip another 2 or 3 months. Go back to spring training. But he goes, now you're going to get to know the coaches. You're going to be able to, when you go to spring training, be ready to rock and roll, and you'll know those guys. So I went to instructional league here in Arizona. Then after that, you know, just that was my first year. I went to spring training. I made the A ball team because I was a little bit older than the younger kids. So I went to Savannah, Georgia, and then I had a good start. I hurt my elbow. And then after the year, during the season, I hurt my, I think it was 2 or 3 months within end season, I hurt my elbow. And it wasn't supposed to be that big of a deal, but then the next spring training, that's when they told me I needed Tommy John. So I missed it a whole year and a half. And that was like,
did you have a strength training, nutrition background at that time?
I had nothing.
Yeah.
I just went on feel. You know, I was just like,
throw hard.
And just, I mean, I would eat decent, I think, for me, for what I knew. I mean, now I know a lot more if I knew what I know now, but no, I just went about what I thought was right. And I didn't eat that much, actually. And I had a little bit of a problems on eating problems. When I went to Seminole, my parents got divorced. I think that came out where I was bulimic a little bit. Mm. So I lost a lot of weight.
Yeah.
And
how have you channeled some of that emotion from your childhood? And it comes out, you know, I'm looking at you and I'm like, man, it's like a mirror in some ways, man. I can tell you've been through some... Not just physical battles, man, but like, you know.
Well, physical is easy.
Yeah.
Right? That's why we put ourselves through physical battles, because mental, if you can deal with that, I mean, a cut's a cut. You know, when you're sad and it doesn't go away, you learn how to like make it go away. That's when you understood, like you understand yourself a little bit. And what I've noticed is I've seen a lot of my friends they're not addicted to drugs. They're addicted to not feeling. You know, the no emotions because they don't know how to deal with it. Yeah. I don't think they want to be numb. I just think they don't know how to understand how to emotions. Like sometimes they're like, fuck me, shit sucks. And I'm like, you can't breathe. I'm like, you're supposed to understand that. Like, it's okay. You know, I'm going to breathe at some point. I'm not going to die because I don't breathe.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just going to relax and understand that, hey, it's okay. Just take your time and just take a step back. And that's what we're doing right now. We're all taking a step back and just kind of chill out, analyze the situation and get back in it with a fresher mind.
What did you negotiate your contract for in what year?
My contract was for $75,000. My first offer was $5,000. And they said they had no money. I'm like, so why you guys want to sign me then?
$75,000. Mm-hmm. In what year is that?
I thought I was rich.
Yeah.
That was in 96. So that was crazy. That was fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was fun because I had no idea what I was doing. I just lied. I just made shit up. I called my dad, actually. My dad's like, Eric, I don't know. He goes, do what you want to do. I'm like, well, I want to sign. He goes, well, sign. Who cares? He goes, how much are they offering? He goes, $5,000. He goes, just ask more. So what'd they say? He goes, is that your first offer? I'm like, yeah. He goes, just ask him whatever. He goes, ask one of your friends. I call my buddy. He goes, yeah, I got $75,000. I got 40 plus 35 for school. I'm like, I don't want school. I want money. And I wanted to take care of my mom. So that's what I did. I got $75,000. It's funny because it was maybe a four hour negotiation, because they could have, if I were to wait the next day, I would have had 25 teams coming in. And I'm like, yeah. I'll sign right now.
Yeah.
Would have, could have, should have, but I'm like,
eh, and then your second contract is with Scott Boras.
I was with Scott. Yep. That was in the minor leagues with Scott. And then, the minor leagues, you don't really negotiate any contract, not until the sixth year in the big leagues. So you have 3 years of basically straight, they do whatever they want with you. And then the next three is arbitration. And then you go on and then you have your free agency. So my free agency was 2 years. I signed two extra years. I did really good on the, because I had a really good year my third year before free agent or arbitration.
On the Dodgers?
Yep, with the Dodgers. Before arbitration, I won the Cy Young. So then I went to my arbitration. I won that one. Then I signed a two-year deal. So I basically had a three-year deal with the Dodgers.
So prior to your Cy Young, you're still making peanuts.
Oh, yeah. You're making $500,000. I won the Cy Young. I made $510,000. And then I went from $510,000 to $5 million for arbitration.
To see a contract as big as, you know, $450 million, do you smile with pride that, you know what, timing is everything? Or do you look at it as, man, that's fucking insane?
I don't see it as insane. I see it where it's value. It's just how much is he worth? That's very simple to me. I think it's, if you look at how much they're making, how much the value of entertainment, if he's that good, he's that good. I mean, they're not dumb. They're not going to pay someone that they can't afford. You know, that's just the way it is. I mean, they're smart. They're smart people. They know what they're doing. They understand the revenues. They understand how much they're going to have to get out to get in. And to me, he's worth more than that. He's worth $1 billion. If you look at Mike Trout, the way he plays, the way he carries himself, how professional he is, to me, he's worth, I mean, it's limitless. There's no value on that. I mean, these are one of a kind, one of a generation players that you're like, hey, you take that out of the equation, it's not the same.
Yeah, I was watching The Last Dance, episode 7 last night, yep. And Jordan's like, I don't know why everybody's making a big deal. The money that I made, nobody would have even been paying attention to me if mm-hmm. I wasn't producing. If I was putting up 6 points and 2 rebounds, I earned my right to make that money.
He does. He still earns it. He's changed the game. He was a game changer. And these guys are like, Trout's a game changer. Barry Bonds is a game changer. All these guys are, you know, as much as they – it could be positive, could be negative, but these guys, influenced the game, and they really grew the game. And that's the whole thing, is understanding, hey, these guys are value. These guys are not just brake pads. No, these guys are human beings. They can make a big difference. And the way you look at it, for me, I look at it as a fan. I look at it like how much it impacted me when I watched. I did a camp with the Expos. It was in a field somewhere. And I remember Tim Wallach was there. Tim Raines, Dawson, they just came in and out. I didn't even talk to them, but they were just there. To me, I felt like it was so personal. And there's 60 of us. They talked for like 5 minutes each, and it just made a huge impact to me. I was like their best friend, you know, and that was pretty special to me to kind of understand that, hey, the impact we have is very important. I didn't realize that. You don't realize that we're not role models, but we do have impact. So it's like you got to pick and choose your poison. You don't want any part of it. And I understand that, because it's demanding to feel like, oh, you're responsible for anybody's action. You're not. I mean, we're not role models. We're all mess up. I mean, we're all have issues. Everybody's got some messed up, stories.
Everybody takes a shit in the morning.
Everybody. It's just, we're all the same. We just happen to throw harder or just be lucky, be at the right place at the right time. It's just, but I think these guys, like the cool thing with Trout, the guys like this, he's worth $500-600 million. And he's like a normal person. Other than he's a huge guy, like you wouldn't even know he's a baseball player making $400 million.
Did you see him hitting here at Top Golf?
Didn't see. Oh yeah, I saw that video. Yeah. That's insane. Yeah, that was insane.
He went.
But that's
over.
What you think. Like you watch him, you're like, wow.
Yeah.
Just watch him swing the golf club. I would pay for that.
Hey, I'm a fan, and I truly believe you did change the game as well, especially when it came to closing. You know, before you, it was Wild Thing. I can't think of his name
Vaughn.
Right now.
Ricky Vaughn.
But even going back. you know, to some of the best closers of all time. You literally, not only from your persona, right, and from your, you know, glasses that, you know, I mean, you had Kareem in the 70s and 80s in LA, right?
Yep.
You had Horace Grant, you had Eric Gagne. Like, when we saw you go out on the mound during those years in LA, was it special for you and where you were in your career, looking back now, being in the spotlight of Los Angeles?
It was really special. First of all, LA was my home. It's my home. It's just like, that's where people know me from. That's where I became somebody. You know, that's where I grew. I mean, I was a little kid from Mascouche, Quebec, Canada, just came to LA and just made it big. I'm like, what the fuck's going on? It's crazy. And I didn't understand that. I mean, seeing yourself on like billboards, it's surreal. That's why like a lot of times people do get lost. Because you see yourself bigger than anything. It's crazy. And but I was lucky. I was grounded pretty well. My parents are pretty good at that. And you know, I could have lost myself. I could have lost my shit easily in LA, but I was married. That helped a lot.
And when did your kids come into the league?
See, I got my daughter, I got her, I was 24 years old. And my ex-wife, she was 23 maybe. And then we started early. I wanted to be done early. I wanted to enjoy life after when I was done playing baseball. So we started early, and then she came in AAA. So she's seen, my daughter has been living in suitcase. Like literally she slept in suitcase. We used to open drawers, a bottom drawer, put a bunch of pillows, put like a little mattress and pillow, and she would sleep in there at the Hyatt downtown LA. I mean, it was literally minor leagues. I mean, you're just living check, you know, paycheck by paycheck.
It sounds like about 6 years of my kid's childhood in CrossFit. We were just building a business and a brand, uh-huh, and they were on sleeping bags, sometimes 4:35 in the morning because they had to.
You know,
man,
it's crazy. They remember that.
Yeah.
I mean, they remember that as much as like, I used to play Lost Child with my friend, and we used to build like houses. You would build houses because I'm not Bob the Builder, that's for sure. But he was building houses. It was just a platform. And we'd go there and bring our lunch. And like, all right, we're going to be here for the whole day. And then I could hear my dad whistle like at 7:30 at night. And I'm like, all right, it's time to go home. Reality check. But that's what we did. I mean, that's why I think kids need to struggle. They need to be uncomfortable. And it's important, I think, for them to understand that you have to go work and get their shit. Like, go get it. Go find it yourself because it's gratifying.
How old is your oldest right now?
My oldest is 19, Faye. Her name is Faye.
And your youngest?
Youngest is Harley. He's 11 years old.
Yeah, 19 born, and 11.
Yep, 19 and 11. And then I got a son is Maddox. He's 16. And Blue, she is 14 or 15.
How do you spell Blue?
Blue.
Ah, yeah. Very cool.
Dodger Blue, my boy Blue, and Blue Sky.
Yeah, very cool. And how often do you communicate? I know you're doing some Zoom, FaceTime stuff all the time. You had a graduation the other day.
Yep, that's right. We do that a little bit. We're just trying to keep in touch. I try, you know, it's weird because I try not to be in touch too much because I miss them too much because they're in Canada. And then the same thing, vice versa. It's almost like I feel like sometimes I'm trying not to call them too much because I know they're going to miss me. So it's like you got to find a balance. That's why it's hard long distance, but you find a balance. It's just, and I guess the more they miss you, the better they realize how much they love you.
Yeah. You said you were grounded. A big part of that was from your mom and your dad. What happened in their relationship that didn't work out?
Communication, I think. It's very simple. I think it's just communication all the time. I think you get stuck in a rut. You get stuck in like arguing the little stupid things and you don't explain yourself. I think you lose yourself a little bit by not talking. A lot of times we hate, like I can't go to bed with my wife right now. I can't go to bed unless we settle the fight. I don't care about fighting. I'm all about fighting. I'm all about arguing, but it's got to stop. And I think a lot of people go to bed mad, and I think that's the worst thing ever. It eats me alive. And my wife's like, you got to drop it. I'm like, I can't drop it. Unless you tell me we're good, you give me a kiss, I can't.
We have a sign above our bedroom door that says, always kiss me goodnight, which is just a little reminder that no matter how shitty it gets.
Because they step on your ego. I mean, and it's hard because everybody has an ego. I have an ego. We all have an ego. We all think we're right. We all think we're the best. We all think we know it all. And we don't.
Going back to LA, how big was your ego during that time? And what was the Lakers organization and even, in hockey with the Kings? Like, what was the professional limelight like for you during those core years?
It was cool. I mean, I met Kobe Bryant. He gave me I can't remember if it was number 7. back then?
8 and 24.
Eight and 24, mm-hmm. Yes. I gave him mine, and I thought I was going to ask for his jersey. I never got it. Never got to it. So I don't know if his daughter was alive back then. That was a long time ago. That was a long, long time ago. I met him at Dodger Stadium. Then I gave him a jersey. It was fun. I mean, Fred Durst. Mm. I met him, Little John at the bar. It's crazy stuff that you, like Bam Margera.
Yeah.
Where
did you live in LA?
I lived in La Cañada, Pasadena. Mm. It was easier to access for a stadium. Yeah. You know, I didn't want to be stuck in Manhattan Beach, and it's too far. I mean, I would love to go there. I love living there, Hermosa Beach and stuff, but it's too far to go to the stadium.
Last weekend, my son and I drove from Palm Springs to Huntington. Hour and 55 minutes, and it was like, wow.
That's
like,
awesome.
This is how it should be.
Yeah.
That's great, man.
There'll be people going there for real now. Yeah. That's awesome. That's cool.
Yeah, so your years in LA, when you made the transition, and this is a big part of today's conversation about adapting and overcoming as we've been forced to do in this new world, mm-hmm. you went from being a starting pitcher to a closer. Was it in the beginning challenging for you, or was that really, you said unleash the beast?
Yeah.
Was it time?
It was time. I mean, I knew, because I actually, for Team Canada, I was a closer. When I signed with the Dodgers, I was a closer. And I don't know if they had in mind of me be a reliever, but what they did is really cool, because they just made me throw innings. And there's nothing like experience. I mean, you can't buy experience. There's just no way around it. And as much as I can tell you, do this, do that, unless you get burnt, you're going to want to touch it. And I think that's really what the Dodgers did. They threw me out there in the fire with any situation. And I think when I became a closer, it fit my personality better. It really was, because by my body, that's the way my body reacts. It's just in big spurts. I mean, it comes out and just fucking, it just wants to go
power.
Crazy. Yeah, power now, let's go. And it feels like my end-eye coordination is better when I'm 100% all out. For some reason, I don't know. That's just me.
You get tunnel vision.
Exactly. I feel like I got to go hard, and it's got to hurt. It's got to, like, it's when I lift, I get mad after I lift. You know, it's like, I don't know why. I do a bench press or whatever I do, and I got to hit something after. It's weird, and I don't understand why, but it's just the way I feel inside. And then I'm all right. I've done it. I push myself. I always tell them, like, unless my nose doesn't bleed, it's not a good lift. You got to stop before you start tasting iron. Like, all right, that's a little much.
like sucking on a nickel, man.
That's
right. That's like, I got a group of guys that are in a mastermind right now that I'm running. Eight dudes from all over the country, just completely different, you know, backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everything about them is different, from one guy who, you know, has a 10-month-old to one guy who's, you know, fighting for custody of his son.
Yeah.
But it's all based on fatherhood. And yesterday's assignment was 100 burpees for time. And of course, you know, I don't dish anything out that I'm not willing to do myself. Every guy had to put it on live video on Workplace mm-hmm. and share it. And everyone's like, you know, a couple guys, I've never done this before. Some guys, like, I did this once at your CrossFit gym 8 years ago.
Oh yeah.
And I'm once a month, I got to do that workout. Because
100 in a row? Or?
It's 100 for time.
I'll try to do that.
Yeah.
I'll try it. I haven't worked out today, so that's perfect.
Oh man.
I've done nothing today.
6, 7, 8, 10 minutes in there.
So you go...
I go 20, 100? 20, 10.
Okay.
10, 10, 10, 10, 10.
I used to do, my ex-wife, we used to do a, she didn't do much. Actually, she was pretty good. We used to do movie push-ups.
Okay.
How many push-ups can we do in a movie?
Oh,
So you get like, all right, you don't want to burn yourself up too early. Like, I got 30. I'm like, oh my God. And you can't go. So I would go one.
Yeah.
Then you got to find your pace. Like, how much do I need? Yeah. It's a long movie, 2.5 hours. I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Watch Munich.
One of the longest bodyweight workouts I've ever done, back in the CrossFit days, right? The crazy days.
Yeah. That's tough.
1,000 pull-ups and 1,000 push-ups. And
that's what my brother does.
It was a Jack LaLanne tribute, old school, you know, the original fitness guy who was on TV. And I wrote out 200 check marks. And I would do 5 pull-ups, 5 push-ups, 5 pull-ups, 5 push-ups. We did it at like an event, like a gala event. Like, I was the freak on display. 4 hours and 56 minutes.
I mean, if you do it right, if you know how much you can push it, like, it's all it is. Like, all right, my legs will give out soon, so back off.
Pushing your edge.
Yeah, get on your shoulders. Yeah. And then.
What's the fastest you ever threw in a game?
There's 100. I don't know if it's true. It was 100. I thought I saw 102 against Barry Bonds that day.
Wow.
That's when the next day I was so sore.
Wow.
My whole right side, it was just shot.
Wow. How did he do, or how did you do?
He hit a bomb.
Ah, shit.
He hit two bombs, actually, that event.
He hit two bombs.
Oh, yeah. He was insane. That's ridiculous. That guy is out of this fucking world. I've never seen anything like it. That guy was just a beast. he sat there and he has such good balance at the plate. And he would not swing at bad pitches. He had the best balance. And he was so fucking calm and collected. You could tell, like, he dominated you just looking at you. And that's why, like, I looked at him. And I think in Japan, we had a bet in Japan. That was the dad bet in Japan. He goes, oh, nobody faces us, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, everybody's scared. They used to put those chicken and San Fran on the outfield. So I'm like, I'll face you if there's no safe situation where I feel like it's a safe situation for me. No, I'm not going to give up the game just for my ego. So that's what the game, and I don't know if you've seen the video on YouTube.
No, but we're going to put it in the show notes.
Oh, you got to see this. It's pretty cool because it's like me against him. And that's a big, I think it was like 60 million views or something.
Wow.
But like, all the kids look at it. But it was a bet we had. I said, hey, I'll face you all fastballs. He goes, no changeup. I'm like, dude. He goes, only on one off speed. So I had to throw my slow curveball. So that was not fair, but I took it. I did
it. How much was the bet for?
No money. It's no just money. Like, you got to do it.
Bet.
Yeah. It's just like, would you do it?
Who's
like,
the alpha?
Yep.
Yeah.
And he won.
Wow.
He almost took my second base, Alex Cora's head off from center field, or from second base. And then he almost took Dave Roberts' head off center field, and the ball just barely went out. It was the loudest freaking sound I've ever seen.
Wow.
Loudest ever. So crazy. Because two pitch before, I threw a fastball down and in right at his kneecap, and he turned on it. But he almost kept it fair. That should have been 100, probably 100 yards foul. And he just kept it almost fair. That was the first one that I felt like it was 520 yards or wow. feet. It was ridiculous.
Were you allowed to hit at all? Once you went from third baseman to pitcher?
I wanted to hit my whole life. Yeah. I got a home run in the big leagues.
Yeah.
Got a home run against Ken Bottenfield.
Yeah.
In Houston at Minute Maid Park, or I think it was called Enron back then.
Wow.
Before the whole Enron deal.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
And then I got sent down to AAA about 2 days later.
Why?
Gave up a 5 spot after my home run.
Wow.
I'm an interval type of guy. I went up and then straight down.
Wow.
So that was crazy.
And how many total years in the league?
I played 11 years in part, and then I played 10 years total. So.
And your biggest accolades, of course, winning a championship, but also the Cy Young.
Cy Young... I didn't like winning Cy Young.
Why?
I don't know. I got to the top of the mountain. I didn't know where to go after that. That was a little weird. That's why I shaved my head. I went to the media event. I had a big old, big fro, big curly hair. And then just before the event, I just shaved everything. And people are like, what is that? I just didn't know what to do. I got on top and I got scared. And they're like,
Who was your closest resources at the time besides your dad?
My best friend, Todd Clausen. He's a guy that just always helped me. He was there with me. He's my trainer. I call him my trainer. He's not my trainer. He's my buddy. You know, I paid my buddy to just be with me all the time. So he was a good friend of mine. And he always helped me out mentally. I mean, he was there to ups and to down. He was in Boston and was getting booed off the field every day. So that's a good story.
Rock bottom for you? Boston?
Yeah, definitely.
One season?
Yep. That's when we won the World Series. That's why, like, it's bittersweet. I won the World Series, and I was terrible. I was getting booed off the field, death threats, and everything else. And I was so excited to go to Boston because I had a no-trade clause. And Alex Cora was there, a good friend of mine. The team was just blue-collar team. You could tell, like, that was my type of team. So I'm like, I want to go there. I had a no-trade clause. I'm like, I want to go to Boston. It happened the last minute, like, literally the last minute before the trade. So I got traded there. And I was so excited. I get there. The media go crazy. We're going to have the best bullpen. We're going to win for sure. I get there. I start sucking so bad. It was
terrible. Who's in the starting rotation?
The rotation was Buchholz, Lester, Lackey, I believe. I think it was Lackey. And the bullpen, we had Papelbon.
Oh, yeah.
Japanese kid. I can't remember his name.
And for you, what happened that season? Was it more physical than mental, or was it just mental?
That season I was doing really good. I was in Texas before the trade. I had a 2 ERA. Physically was bad because I had my back surgery the year before, and I was kind of banged up. And then I pitched two or three games in 2 days. And then that's when my shoulder gave out. I went to Boston, and then I got a couple shots in the shoulder, but it wasn't really – it was everything. It was a combination of mentally trying to do too much, changed my routine because I wasn't closing anymore. Papelbon was closing, so I agreed not to close, but I wasn't prepared to do that. My routine didn't change. I should have changed my routine before. I just was thrown in there. I wasn't prepared, I think, mentally. And then I tried to do too much. I tried to – if I can win the World Series by myself, and that doesn't really work. I had a 6 ERA, got booed off, and I live right next to the stadium. I was so excited when I got traded. A nice, really cool, like, condo, huge condo. literally right next to the stadium. I didn't think I was going to suck. But I walked home every time. Like, oh my God. Dude, I was getting thrown stuff at all day, every day. A reminder how bad I sucked every single time I walked out.
It obviously got in your head.
Oh, yeah. And it gets in your dome no matter what. I don't care what anybody says. It does. I mean, we care about it. I mean, there's a guy, I remember Jeff Gent used to say, I don't care about this game. That's just a defense mechanism, I think. People say they don't care. Third baseman
for the Giants?
Yep. He used to say, I don't care. I'm like, that's not true. You might say that you don't care, but there's nobody that, you know, doesn't care about what other people think. And you might say, fuck, I don't give a shit, but you do. It affects people in a certain way. You got to find a way not to let it affect you. But now I've learned a little bit about it, and that's why I liked it.
Now.
Yeah, I got booed. I don't think anybody's ever getting booed on the World Series parade. I did.
Wow.
I got booed during the World Series parade. I used to have to take my ducks with my son with me. And I'm like, everybody's booing me. I'm like, are you guys serious right now? There's 4 million people or 3 million people, whatever, at the World Series parade. They're booing me after we won the World Series. I'm like, that's crazy. But to me, it was actually funny. I took that and I found a Yankee shirt. It was a little kid had a Yankee suck shirt. He was holding it. So I took it. I put it on my son. My son looked like a stud. He had long curly hair, like so pretty when he was younger. And he had a t-shirt, Yankee sucks. I would hold him up and they would cheer like crazy.
You found a way to come back, man. Oh, yeah. I love it, man.
During the whole thing, I just kept holding up my son. And my son's like, oh, my God.
He's
like 5 or 6 years old. That's pretty funny.
All right, we're going to call this quick fire. I'm going to name a city and you're going to respond with one word answers. Whatever that city means to you or what it represents. Texas.
Friendly.
Boston.
Beautiful.
Milwaukee.
Beer.
Los Angeles.
Love.
Quebec.
Home.
Scottsdale.
Home. Second home.
Beautiful. So when did you know that it was time to move on?
I still don't think I should move on, but I still think I can pitch. I still want to pitch in the Olympics. I want to be the oldest guy. You know, I can't give it up, and I can't pitch as much, but I'll find somewhere to pitch, and I might go pitch until I can't pitch anymore. Maybe I can't anymore, but I'll try. I always test myself if I can keep doing it.
What does your routine look like right now from a training standpoint?
I work up every morning. I do like water yoga because I don't want to hurt myself too, because I'm really flexible. I'm really stubborn. So I do water yoga, a little bit to stretch, and then I get on the ground and I start doing a little more stretching and everything else. And I really got into stretching more because I'm very flexible, but I think it helps my back. It helps my body stretch. It helps my blood circulation. I do that. I'll get on the pre-core. I'll either do bike. Every 2-3 days, I'll do bike. And I get burnt a lot now, so I kind of back off the bicycle a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I do bike. I do cardio. I do a lot of swimming. I love swimming. I love water. I need to be in the water because my back and everything else. And it feels like I relax more in the water. And
we do. Humans got to be in the water. Oh, man.
It feels like. Yeah. I'm always in the water. I take a bath every morning. Then I go in a cold water and do my yoga there. And then I go on my bike. I got a little gym at the house, so it's perfect. I do a lot of body weight training. I change. I mean, I don't have one set routine. I kind of watch videos and I try stuff. You know, that's pretty much it. Yeah. I don't have one thing. I like to stretch. I like to do cardio. I like to lift.
And what about throwing?
Throwing, I still throw on the wall every day. I do videos. Yeah, I do videos for guys. There's a couple guys in Japan right now that are stuck there. So I send them videos out of practice because they're really stuck in a little apartment for, I don't know, 16 hours a day.
You're doing some coaching, mentoring?
Yeah, just coaching, video coaching. Try to send them, hey, do this, the breathing. So I do a lot of breathing technique. I do Wim Hof. I love the Wim Hof. I started doing that probably 8 months ago. And, you know, I didn't really follow per se perfectly, but I kind of took little bits and pieces and kind of modified it for me because there's stuff that you want to do perfectly, but unless it's tailored to you, it won't work.
Yeah.
So for me, I kind of tailored that a little bit to myself and the way I do during daily. You know, they say I do it 3 times a day, and I don't do it perfectly for 15 minutes, but I think about it 3 times a day.
Yeah.
And I get in the car, I do my breathing.
Yeah.
Just stuff
conscious
like this.
Breathing is what we call it, man. Yes. Just being aware.
Yeah.
Right. We can talk and we can move all day long, but when we stop to
always.
See, breathe the good air, man. It's good. It's a good feeling.
You can't live without breathing.
No, it's so powerful.
Yep. Smell around. You know, smell what's around. I love it. Like, that's what I tell the guys. Like, what do you miss about baseball? I miss the friends. I miss the smell of beer after a win. The old champagne on your shirt. You miss the grass and you miss the hot dog smell. You know, you miss smells, and it's amazing how you miss either songs, music, and smell.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty cool.
Yeah. One more piece about that last dance, Jordan, last night, right before he goes out to, I think it was game six against LA. He says, actually, no, it was the first round at the second back to back to back. And he said, boys, it starts with hard work. It ends in champagne.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. So that is the mindset then from the moment you get into the league is championship mentality.
Yep.
What happens if you're on a shit team? When that happens, is it hard to maintain
pride
that?
Other stuff. I mean, take pride in showing how to win to others. I think for me, that's the biggest thing. And to me, like, that's why I like coaching. I like coaching because I like the kids listen. They want to get better. You see them get better. You take pride in it. It's almost like become your kids. And it's weird because I got guys that come to the house. They're like double A guys, triple A guys. There's Justin Therrien. He's been with me since he was 16. He just got hurt last year. He's been hurt for 2.5 years, his elbow. He brought his elbow. He got to the big leagues for a month. He got the taste of it. Blew out right there. So it's been hard, but he's been with me for about, I don't know, 7 years now, 8 years. And he's a good kid. He works hard. And, you know, I kind of do – he's kind of my little
protege.
Yeah, my protege. And you know, I do stuff with him. I train with him. I push him. I tell him he sucks. I tell him he's better. I tell him he needs to get better. And you know, it's like a kid. It's almost like a kid. And I don't think he has a – he doesn't have a father, I think. But he's like – he's such a good kid. His mom is amazing. She works a lot with kids, like problem kids and everything else. So you could tell, like, he's really grounded. He works so hard. He's a good kid. And Justin's like – talk to him every day, and he's in Montreal now. So, and where is that? His hometowns are very hit, they're really hard. So I kind of send him videos again, try to keep him occupied. The same thing. I do the same thing with my kids because they love baseball now, hockey. So
yeah,
just keep them busy. So, keep them thinking about something else.
So we got to share how this thing actually happened. You know, it's part of the whole package, man, and why it's so important to talk to people authentically because I second guessed my response to you at first, which was not what I sent to you. So
hey, if you're not a good second guesser, you're a freaking idiot, right? That's what McClendon always said.
Here's how it goes. Gagne walked into CrossFit Scottsdale somewhere around 08-09, and he joined and he was traveling, so he didn't come back in. And for somehow, some reason, my wife is going to be like, I told you that email list is important. Over the years, we have this list of everybody who's ever been in our gym or done an event, or, you know, we put on these competitions all over the world, and it's about 16,000 people. And since I started using it, it's dwindled down to 12, which is what we want. That's awesome. The real people that are on there. And I just pumped out content all of April. And one of my last pieces was like, you're either all in or you're all out. And within minutes, Eric responds, all in. And I look at the name and I'm like, Eric Gagne. This motherfucker. I was like, wait a second.
That's the guy that got scared to come in.
No, you weren't scared.
Really. I was scared. Trust me. I was scared. I've seen my brother do it. Hey, like, I don't know, man. Well, I remember it was a maniac. So
I called you out and it was like, dude, is this even the right guy? Is this the real person or somebody hacked into him? Is somebody catfishing him? And he's like, nah, man, it's me. And I was like, great. And then I said, what's your cell phone? And we started texting.
Yep.
And I believe the power in that message is that we are all human, right? And that's where you can peel back the ego and let go of everything and know that, you know, people are going through shit all the time, regardless of what they may look like, you know, on social media or in the media in general. You know, you're human. And what I believe you respected on the back end was this guy is calling me out. And I was like, dude, let's get together. And we got on a phone call and had a great conversation. It was easy, man.
To me, I think, like you said, like if you think you're going to become someone else by lying to yourself, like it's not working and people is going to, it's going to come out. Like at some point your shit that you talked about other people, your stuff that you've lived through, it's going to come out somehow. Either you drink too much, you're going to say something stupid, or you get in a fight and you can't control your emotions. So might as well get it all out. And that's what I told my wife. She goes, man, you're so mean with people. I'm like, I'm not mean. Like, she goes, well, you never say nice things. I'm like, I say nice things. I just don't like, I'm not very good at, I don't milk it very well. I'm like, hey, let's go. Just, that's what I feel like. And if you don't like it, tell me and then we'll talk about it and that's it. And I, cause I don't, I try and I do judge, of course.
Yeah.
I have my opinions, but If you tell me why, I'll listen.
This is a podcast for men and fathers. So the language we use is that we kick people in the dick. and they understand that, right? What that means is, like, you know, somebody comes to you with some bullshit or a story, yeah, or, hey, Eric, I would love the chance. I get these emails in from other people and they're just so unauthentic,
yeah,
that it turns me off. That I've realized that I got to talk to people the way I talk to them in real life, yeah, on print or on copy.
Point. Just get to the, yeah, point, right? Just like, yeah, hey, you want to talk? Yes or no?
Yeah. Yeah.
If you don't, I'm going to ask someone else. You know, it's like,
let's roll. Let's, yeah, get right into, exactly, it. No bullshit, no filter.
Yep.
It feels good to
it does. To be it's free. Easy because it's easy to talk when you don't have to look what you're saying. And, yeah, when you have to check everything you say, it's difficult because you can't really say exactly what you want. And especially when you think the way I think, filters are not welcome.
Unfiltered, yeah, unapologetically authentic.
I do apologize a lot, though. I have to.
You're sincere about it, though, right? It's real. All right. So we ask this question to every dad that comes on the show. If today were your last day on earth, what would you want your kids to know about you? And what would you want history to know about who you were?
That I'm a good person. That's it. Just that I'm a good person. I care a lot and I want to do good. Simple. If you remember me, like my dad, I remember my dad's laugh. I remember all the good stuff. And I think that's what's pretty amazing about human beings. We remember the good stuff. There's so much shit, negative stuff around us. Just focus on the positive, good stuff, the positive stuff, because you really don't think about it all the time. But fuck, our life is good. You know, it's really good. As much, even if we're fucking stuck between walls, we could be in a jail and never come out. I mean, it could be worse. It could always be worse. And a lot of times, like, oh, I miss my kids, or I wish I was there for them. I'm like, yeah, I trust them, you know. And it's hard to say that because I'm like, I got to trust my ex-wife. I got to trust her husband or her boyfriend. I got to trust everybody around them. I'm like, but I trust my kids more than I trust, like, they're going to be good people. And if I feel like if I believe that, they're going to feel that at some point. And they're going to be drawn to positive. And my dad's always said, he goes, you know what? Have you noticed where, if you play, I don't know if you guys play golf, but if you know, just notice, if you play golf and there's music in one cart, most people will gather around that cart. You know, if you have good, positive music, it's weird because a lot of times, like, if there's music, I kind of go, every time I make the mistake, I go to, there's that cart. It's not even my cart, but I'm drawn to energy. Positive. Exactly. Yeah. You're drawn to positive energy. You're drawn to a smile, a laugh. And I think it's contagious. And it's as much as that virus is contagious, I think positive thinking, just like, fuck it, let's go. Let's figure it out. I mean, nobody knows anything. Just figure out, respect each other, and just be good. Do good.
Beautiful. My brother, Eric Gagne, I appreciate you for here today, appreciate man. It. Thank you for your time.
Glad I made it.
Hell yeah, man. Hey.
And that coffee's amazing.
Yeah. Sip Coffee. We appreciate you guys for having us here. Again, check out Sip Coffee and Beer in Old Town Scottsdale and here in Arcadia. We thank you guys for being here. You could be anywhere in the world, but you chose to be here with us. We put on an event, for those of you that know, called The Crucible, which is one of the hardest training programs on planet Earth, mentally, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. And since the pandemic has locked us down, we have been unavailable to do these real live experiences, as they do take some one-on-one coaching. We put small groups of men together, and it's a battlefield. And we are proud to announce that we are going to be launching our next Crucible for so many people around the country who are stuck, who are trapped. Arizona is open. And what, we're not taking this thing lightly. We're just simply saying that, you know, we have a lot less people than California. Yep. We've got a tenth of the amount.
We're lucky.
Right? We're very fortunate, but we are doing business as normal. So we want to support local, but we also want to bring people into the state. And I know there's a lot of former major leaguers who are really starting to look at Arizona as a place to come. Mm-hmm. They've even mentioned that there might be, the MLB season coming here.
That would be really sweet.
Right?
That would be sweet.
It would be amazing. This place is amazing and it is beautiful. And we're going to be doing the Crucible July 17th and 18th, July 17th and 18th. I'll put it in the show notes, but we appreciate you guys for being here. If you want to come to Scottsdale, spend some time on a mountain, doing some water yoga and just being free. I think that's the biggest thing that you and I connected on, is the ability to create freedom in your life.
It feels good to feel.
Feels good to feel, brother. Thank you guys for being here. Eric,
thank you.
Again, thank you, brother.
And excuse my French again.
Game over.
Thank you, guys.